Tax and Local Government Finance Division to order. We will begin with the approval of the minutes from March 14, 2018. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Representative Hertas moves approval of the March 14, 2018 minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes, approving, thank you, Madam Chair. Approving the minutes from March 14, 2018, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are approved. Members, we are going to begin with Representative Sandsteed and her bill, so we'll deviate from the agenda slightly, and then we'll get back in order. But Representative Sandsteed has a testifier from a long distance, and we'd love to have normal, regular people instead of lobbyists here before our committee. So thank you, sir, and thank you, Representative Sandsteed. And we want you, sir, to be able to get back on the road to Hibbing and do the good work you do so that you can help pay the taxes for this big government in the state of Minnesota we have. So, members, we'll start with Representative Sandsteed's bill, which is House File 2826. Representative Carlson moves that House File 2826 is entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Sandsteed, to the Property Tax Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill. House File 2826 is a bill requesting tax-exempt status for the Iron Range Racing Association that leases the track from the city of Hibbing. Currently, they're considered a nonprofit, but they do not have a 501c3 status. They were in the process of requesting that and going through the process of the exemption when the person in charge of that was tragically killed in a car accident. So they are still seeking that, but currently they fall under the category, basically, are considered, at least through the Secretary of State's office, a nonprofit organization. It's kind of a unique situation, and this is really a mutually beneficial situation between the Racing Association and the city. It's a great thing that happens for our community, and we would like to make it possible for the Iron Range Racing Association to continue to function and bring this to our communities. Today I have a testifier with me, Trevor Ahrens. He is the president of the association, and he can he's here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Representative Sandsteed. Welcome, Mr. Ahrens. Could you please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed, sir?
My name is Trevor Ahrens. I'm the president of the Iron Range Racing Association. This is my second year as the president of the Racing Association, and we're the managing group of Hibbing Raceway. We are structured as a nonprofit corporation with elected officers and a membership.
Thank you, Mr. Ahrens. Anyone else would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And we do have concerns with this bill, just like we had with the other exemption bills that were heard last week. We have checked with the St. Louis County Assessor on these particular properties, and these are straight leases to the operator of the raceways. And our thought at the time, and given that situation, is that they are taxable as personal property, according to the statute, and that the tax lien is against the person who operates the raceway.
Thank you, Mr. May. Anyone else would like to testify? Members, questions for Mr. Ahrens or Mr. May or Representative Sandsteed? Mr. Ahrens, anything else you'd like to elaborate on kind of what the impetus for the bill or kind of why we're here today?
Yes, we've been paying property taxes upwards about $3,000 plus a year for several years now. And we're also, I'm working with Proctor Speedway on this bill. We're nonprofit organizations, and the buildings, the places we lease them from the city. We have long-term leases from the city, and we just, we don't feel we should have to pay property taxes when we don't own any of the property that we lease from the city. None of it is ours. We don't own any of the land or any part of the racetrack or its facility. So,
thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Ahrens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a kind of a conundrum because the property is owned by a public entity, but then it's leased to a private entity that is not a not-for-profit, correct?
That's what I heard, Representative Erickson. Yes.
So right now it's not, there's no property tax because it's publicly owned.
Mr. Hines, can you tell us a little bit about this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe right now it is taxable. The lease, if it's leased to the organization, it would be taxable. And that's why they need this bill.
Representative
Erickson? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I understand that, but isn't that a conflict? I mean, do we do this all the time, publicly owned, but leased privately?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, yes, we do. There's a statute that says that basically if it's exempt property but it's leased by a private enterprise, it's taxed as if it was owned by that leasing enterprise.
Is that true in the state?
Kind of like the soccer stadium.
Yeah, I guess so.
Representative Erickson. Thank Other you. Questions, members? Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that last question, then, is this common among our other speedways tax exempt? Do we know? Is this common in the state, or are other speedways taxable?
Well, does anyone know the answer? Does anyone know of any other racetracks that are exempt? Representative New.
So no one knows, is that the answer?
Not so far.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier mentioned that they're in the process of working on getting their 501c3, so if they acquire that, would that change the situation here and allow them to become tax exempt?
Mr. Hines? If they get their 501c3, does that change the approach?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know. Let me look into that a little bit more.
Other questions, members? Okay, hearing none, we'll research that last question, Representative Anderson. Representative Sunstein, the closing comments.
Again, this is just a very unique situation. It's good for our community. It's a good it's a good relationship between the association and the city, and I would appreciate your support on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandstein, and thank you for the treats, Representative Sandstein.
You're welcome.
With that, Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 2826 be laid over for possible inclusion, and that House File is laid over. Next, we will have Representative Nash, House File 3814. Representative Barr moves that House File 3814 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Nash.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I want to first thank co-authors here in committee, Representative Drozkowski, Representative Marquardt. Thanks for being on this bill with me. It's a good bill. It's a really clarifying piece of language that essentially puts forward the idea that current law prohibits the tax or increased tax on some of these things that are in the bill. And you know, before we brought the bill forward, I asked the stakeholders to put together a really strong coalition of folks, very wide bipartisan support of both stakeholders and members here in the legislature, and I'm proud to say that we have accomplished that. So again, thanks to those on both sides of the aisle. But what we're trying to accomplish is to avoid heavy taxation of things that you and I buy every day. Could be a bottle of pop, could be a food item in a package or a container. And we're just trying to clarify what we see as existing statute. So to be brief, Mr. Chair, I do have a testifier or several testifiers, so I'm going to let them go from here because I know you have a busy schedule.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Welcome, Mr. Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Tim Wilken. I'm the president of the Minnesota Beverage Association, and I'm here today representing the Coalition for Affordable Food, which is a broad coalition of agriculture and business groups that are listed on the one pager in your packet. As Representative Nash stated, this bill seeks to clarify the current public finance law that prohibits local governments from imposing a new tax or increasing a current tax on sales or income. This clarifies the law to make sure that it's well understood that it prohibits taxes on things that are defined as food as defined in current statute or the packaging that it comes in. What we've seen around the country is groups have come in from outside into cities, putting pressure on them to put a tax on one specific item or another. And I think the coalition's reflective of, they know they might just be down the list a little further, even if they're not the current target of such a tax effort. So there's no efforts by anyone to tax these items right now. There's no such taxes on the books now. So this is a good time to clarify it before there's a conflict that is divisive and costs people a lot of money in litigation and lost jobs, as has happened elsewhere. Just also want to point out that the Teamsters are also supporters of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Wilken. Any other testifiers on the bill? Representative Nash?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, in the effort to achieve consensus with all the stakeholders, we worked with the League of Minnesota Cities to do an amendment that brings them into, I believe, either support or neutrality, and that's being passed out to you right now, Ms. Dalton, and you had that drafted. If you would mind walking us through that, Mr. Chair, if we could move that as well.
We have House File, Amendment H3814A1 in front of us. Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this amendment was worked out with Mr. Wilken and my understanding is with Mr. Gary Carlson, and it basically says that this doesn't apply to reasonable license fees on things like restaurants and things like that that are part of the regulatory job of a city.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Well, I envision, Ms. Dalton, members, another amendment that would have been to strike out 1.11 through 1.13. But Mr. Carlson's looking up. I'm certainly not going to offer that amendment, but that would have been made the bill so much better. With that, Representative Barr moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion on the A1 amendment, members. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 is adopted. Mr. Carlson, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Nash and Mr. Wilken for working with us. We circulated the language of this bill late last week, early this week, to get reaction. And the amendment that you just adopted does address the major concern that was raised by some of the city attorney community, in that we wanted to make sure that the addition of the term fee in 477A016 did not trigger some sort of a restriction on our ability to license products and services as we currently do under current law. When we license a product, we set the fee such that you cover the cost of the administration of the fee or of the license and the cost of enforcement and compliance. We don't want to have a situation where we have to subsidize the cost of licensing products and services through the general fund. So this amendment will carve out the fees and allow us to continue to set those fees according to the cost of administering and enforcing those licenses. I've mentioned to Representative Nash that we're still receiving some comments on the bill, and if there's anything else that arises before we put together the division report, we'll certainly work with Representative Nash and Mr. Wilkin to try to address those concerns. But the amendment you just adopted does address the major concern I've heard to date.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Anyone else would like to testify on this bill? House File 3814. Members' questions? Wow. Presenters did a great job, Representative Nash. Representative Nash, if you want to close it up.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, Representative Barr renews her motion that House File 3814, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. House File is laid over, as amended. Representative Petersburg, House File 2254. Representative Lunan moves that House File 2254 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank the committee for hearing this bill. This bill refers to the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Statute, and that is was passed about 20 years ago in 1997. And I thought before we get into the bill, I'd give a brief overview about how the system works, because it's not very well known out there. But this was really, and I wanted to read the purpose.
Representative Petersburg, let's put the D, let's do the D, so we're looking at the right page here.
Thank you.
Representative Lunan moves to amend House File 2254 by adopting the DE-10 amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the DE-10 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The DE-10 is adopted, and we have that before us rather than the original bill. Representative Petersburg, sorry, please proceed.
No, Mr. Chair, you're very welcome. Thank you for allowing me to do this. The system... the Minnesota system of ad valorem property taxation does not adequately recognize the unique financial circumstances of homestead property owned and occupied by low-income senior citizens. It is therefore declared to be in the public interest of this state to stabilize tax burdens on homestead property owned by qualifying low-income senior citizens for a deferral of certain property taxes. That's the purpose of this statute. That's the purpose of what we're doing here. Basically, how it works is individuals with $60,000 or less in income that are age 65 and older can qualify for having their property taxes deferred in the upcoming next year. And there are some safeguards put in place. Obviously, any liens and other things that are encumbering the property have to be at least cleared up, except for the mortgage, etc. And the total of the deferment plus what is owed against the property cannot exceed 75% of the value of the home, just to make sure that senior citizens don't get caught in an upside-down valued situation as well. But this really does help the individual, because whereas the tax is not forgiven, which some might think, it is actually only deferred, it does stop penalties, it does stop interest, etc., because the state pays for it, and then upon either satisfaction or through the sale of the house or whatever, the taxes will then get paid, the state will get paid back what it deferred, etc., and it's a program really designed to be a help and stopgap. Some of the issues that have been arising over the years revolve around some of the requirements for paperwork and deadlines and other things that have made it less clear for a lot of individuals about what is needed and when. In talking with the department, the July 1st deadline, which was originally set up, most people don't think about it until their second half of the taxes, which is usually in November, and then they... then they're too late for that up next year, so then it drags out for another year. Then they're in penalties and other things that make it even more difficult for them to pay and clear up the liens, and etc. So this process, as you can see, we're in DE-10, has been worked on and worked on, and we're at least getting to where I think we're going to have some help for individuals into the future. We do know that there are some issues in the past where people are still having trouble clearing up all of their liens. They're still getting some of the forfeiture, foreclosures, etc. And we may have to do that with another bill. Now, I thought this morning when I came in that the DETM had resolved all the issues with the department, and I'm understanding that the department still has a little bit of heartburn, and they'll come up and talk about that. But I'd like to run over the DE-10 with exactly what it does. It changes the initial due date from July 1st to November 1st. And there's also provisions in there that allows for a pending status under Subdivision 2, which gets into later, on December 1 or later. And I think that's where the department has some issue in timing of getting it paid for as well. But we also want the individual to know that they can always apply ahead of time, and then the commissioner may tell them exactly what is necessary for them to have their application complete and accepted, so they have time still for the November 1st deadline in order to reapply. So that's in that first section on page 1, 1.6 all the way down to 1.11. And then, let's see, with my other part of the sheet here. And then in the approval process on page 3, it really talks about an incomplete application. Now, how the system works is that if it's not complete or it gets denied, that doesn't necessarily preclude the next application to also talk about pre-existing taxes that aren't paid as well in the previous years. And so that there is a possibility that that could be included. But anyway, this in 3.6 to 3.9 really talks about how to satisfy an incomplete application and allow individuals to go ahead and get the proper paperwork, etc. And then the final revisor's instructions are just changing initial application and just changing it to application in most cases that are listed there. In a nutshell, this really is trying to make it easier for senior citizens to understand, easier for the department to apply and make provisions. The department thinks the November 1st deadline is okay in this particular situation, but I'll let them refer to that when they come to testify. And so, Mr. Chair, I think that's my presentation, and I think we have a few testifiers here as well. Ms. Lee beside me as well.
Thank you, Representative Peters, both for your bill and for the detailed description of it. Ms. Lee, welcome. I just want to mention, Ms. Lee, there was an email that went out from some of the supporters of this bill, and I may not have to even mention this, but I will. Sometimes when people go overboard on their descriptions and turn things into kind of a hyperbolic approach in order to present their talking points on a bill, it can be counterproductive, and people are not going to die or not die because of this bill, and we can't have that type of hyperbole in order to be successful going forward. So I think there's a lot of people that support seniors, probably everybody in this room. There's probably a lot of people that support the impetus behind this bill. But I think I know there were some things directed at the department in the email that weren't fair to them. And I would encourage you and other supporters of this bill to refrain from that type of rhetoric so that we can have a good discourse going forward that achieves the best outcomes. Ms. Lee, welcome.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill that we requested for passage. I'm Reverend Dr. Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, which does public policy and legal advocacy, Honor Family Centers, which provides shelters, transitional permanent housing and services, and a lot of these shelters are your safety shelters, so we have to protect the victims within. And also the APAC, the Housing Consortium, which is made up of over 2,000 members and organizations. We also have the Metropolitan Interfaith Coalition of Affordable Housing and the Cultural Ethnic Community Leadership Council that I'm representing. I'm a former Fortune 500 corporate auditor and have been in housing for 54 years. We are requesting passage of the March 9th House File 2254, delete all, which you were handed out copies of in the second page. And it's to help seniors, including the disabled and vulnerable adults, keep their homes and avoid the costly consequences of facing loss of their homes and homelessness when they actually can qualify for the senior tax deferral program, but were denied for various reasons from being in the program. We have some of the data on the effects of denial and costs that were created that shifted to other agencies, which taxpayers paid through increased taxes, insurance premiums, or through the various systems, versus the increased revenues to the state, where 5% is compounded annually by a senior being accepted into the senior deferral program, and essentially, as he mentioned, it puts the taxes on the back end like a reverse mortgage. There has been no data collected by cities, counties, courts, agencies, and others involved. And also, I did ask, and I understand just recently the Department of Revenue has come up with some data, but at the time I asked, they weren't keeping the data. So we couldn't come up with the total cost impact of these other systems. The cost data is as a result of the different effects, and it's shown in the document, which was on the page one, as far as the details like stress and trauma, Alzheimer's, hospitalization, and so forth. When a disqualified senior is denied from the tax deferral program, they can lose their home through tax forfeiture or enter into what's called a 10-year confession of judgment, or COJs. Both have devastating effects on seniors beyond the stress and trauma and the increased medical costs that all of them, that happens to all of them. We and other organizations have cases where tax forfeiture, or also called foreclosures, have caused homelessness and all the costs associated with that. You have seen in the bonding bill the costs, including the $140 million this year in appropriations each year to solve problems for a limited number of the homeless population. And within that are some of these cases. Minnesota Housing Partnership reported that it would take $106 billion to address affordable housing costs and homelessness. And so we're saying that it's cheaper to keep the seniors in their home by giving them alternatives through this program and amending some of the different sections we were told couldn't would disqualify them from the program. Some of the case scenarios, and because we are dealing with domestic violence and other victims, they've asked me to testify on their behalf. And so I will be telling you about some of the cases that are, and also some of the cases are in court, and so I'm limited into what I can talk about. But here are some of the case scenarios and costs that were shifted to other departments in affecting seniors who were traumatized, exploited. They faced medical costs. Some suffered strokes, and you know there was one that also had a heart attack. Now, the developing disability and dealing with other systemic problems. So this is one case where a senior had developing disabilities and other systemic problems that prevented them from paying their taxes and caused them to be delinquent. He wasn't told about the 3-year clock for forfeiture of the home, nor did he get help from the senior deferral program. Within a few months of the tax forfeiture, someone notified him of the program and to apply. So the application was made before the July 1st deadline, and despite telling the Department of Revenue about delays in getting the documents they requested from the county assessor, the recorder, the abstract company, and the courts, the Department of Revenue denied the application in like a month or two, but definitely before July 1st. systemic problems then escalated, became more complex, and there wasn't any help from either taxpayer services, senior linkage line, legal aid, or other organizations and state agencies. And they asked for help from the Department of Revenue and didn't get help. So seniors who entered, another case is when seniors enter this confession of judgment, they're still at risk of immediate homelessness in any half year if they can't meet the terms, despite paying the extra fees and penalties and taxes through that program. The COJs also prevent seniors from getting any fix-up loans from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, banks, Habitat for Humanities, Brush of Kindness, and other lenders, besides lowering the credit score that they need to get a loan and increasing their insurance premiums. Seniors then face code violations when the cities, through last year's law, are able to liberally interpret a code violation. And the system, that system created other fines, penalties, assessments against the senior property, it created misdemeanor charges against the senior that's on their record needing expungement, and they're facing jail, so we're still working on that case to try and keep them out of jail. We have other cases where seniors are paying taxes, but they're facing these penalties, and it's costing extra as far as city and county employees, prosecutors and defenders, and the courts, which are also impact on taxpayers' expense. They also have, the seniors who are going through the court systems have increased health care costs and loss of income. And these, again, are costs that are being picked up by the taxpayers. We have another case where a senior with disabilities had disabilities and Alzheimer's that wasn't diagnosed in time, and that person died because of loss of the home through tax forfeiture. And systemic problems were the delays in getting the documents and the format accepted by the program, because they had the documents available, but it wasn't in the format that the program wanted. There was over $300,000 of equity in that home that could have been tapped, but the help came too late. There's now pending litigation and other actions in process, so I'm limited in what I can talk about it.
Ms. Lee, are you almost complete?
I'm almost complete, yes.
Okay. And by the way, nobody died because of this bill or lack of the bill. Please proceed.
The dilemma seniors face include no legal aid or taxpayers' assistance in the issue, no taxpayer education and training on the issues, and they don't know until the last minute about getting forms in acceptable formats that the deferral program wants. They're also vulnerable to other fraud and exploitation. I mentioned the stakeholders, advocates, and others that wanted to fix the problem, thought they could fix it through the Red Brook Avenue that the Department of Revenue has, but they were excluded from that process. So we were asking for the remedies that were provided in the March 9th delete all of it. Number one, tolls the time for an incomplete application delayed by the various processes like through city, county, and the courts. And two was to keep the original application so that they could get expungements and get their loans and other remedies where the date is critical. And we have supporters that include not only the agencies that I named as far as Children's Hope, MICA, Metropolitan Interfaith Council, R&R, but members of the Disability Council, Board of Aging, Cultural and Ethnic Community Leadership Council, American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, Alzheimer's Association, AARP Coalition of Asian American Leaders, Homes for All, Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless, and others, that nonprofits that have other members within their membership. Thank you.
Lee, anyone else would like to testify on this bill? Mr. Cummings?
Yes.
Welcome, Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to talk to Representative Petersburg and Ms. Lee earlier this week about this hearing. If it is helpful to the committee, I might provide some additional information about the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. As Representative Petersburg mentioned, this deferral program was established to help senior citizens who are having difficulty paying for their property taxes. And it has two primary advantages for seniors. Really, it limits the maximum amount of property tax a senior pays to 3% of their income, and it provides predictability. The amount of tax you paid by the senior citizens will stay the same as long as they remain in the program. This is basically a low-interest loan from the state. It is not a tax forgiveness program. The state pays the counties their property taxes directly and charges the homeowner interest on the amount paid. Some seniors are reluctant to join the program because a lien will be attached to their property. The program typically has about 300 to 350 enrollees per year. In 2017, there was 334. Many seniors come on and off each year. In order to qualify for this program, all of the following conditions must be met. First, the property must be owned and homesteaded by a person 65 years of age or older. Second, the total household income cannot be more than $60,000 for the calendar year before the year of the initial application. Third, one of the homeowners must have owned and lived in the home for at least 15 years before the year they submit their first application. Fourth, there can be no state or federal tax liens or judgment liens on the property. In both our fact sheet and application, it is very clear that the applicant must provide a report detailing any mortgages, liens, judgments, or unpaid property taxes on the property with their application. Fifth and finally, the total of unpaid debts secured by mortgages and other liens against the property cannot be more than 75% of the assessor's estimated market value of the property. This program not only protects the interests of state and local governments, it also, just as importantly, protects the senior. The program ensures that a senior is not piling on new types of debt that is unsustainable. Those requirements also provide clear guidance to the department in administering the program. Once in the program limits the maximum amount of property tax you pay to 3%. Upon approval, it also defers delinquent property taxes, penalties and interest, and delinquent special assessments. And if they are denied an application 1 year, they can apply the next year for the program if they meet the conditions. When the senior leaves the program, the deferred property taxes, any special assessments that may have been deferred, penalties plus any recording or filing fees will become due, and they will need to pay this to the state. No additional interest will be due if the senior pays the state on time. If the deferral is not paid on time, the penalty, interest, lien, forfeiture, and other rules for the collection of the property will apply. When the senior reaches the point that they have to pay off the deferred amount, the program criteria ensures that they will financially be able to do so. Otherwise, it could put seniors in a dire financial situation. As I mentioned before, I was able to talk to Representative Petersburg earlier this week. We did agree that the senior deferral program is an important tool for seniors and that that tool could be improved. In fact, in 2015 and every year since, the governor has requested inclusion of two common sense proposals in the tax bill to increase participation in the program. First, the governor recommended moving the application date from July 1st to November 1st. This proposal is because we heard from taxpayers after the second half property taxes were due that they had trouble paying for that payment, and then they would have to wait another year to get any relief from the deferral program. About 18 months, I guess. Second, the governor recommended changing the occupancy threshold from 15 years to 5 years. Because the lien threshold didn't change and the amount of equity that they needed didn't change, the occupancy threshold was a requirement to the program that could be easily modified without hurting seniors' ability to pay back the property taxes. So those two changes, we estimated that these would increase participation by about 20%. Yesterday, I reached out to our taxpayer rights advocate, Sarah Bronson, to ask how many times her office deals with complaints about the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. She said that the number is very small. However, she noted that our office does field calls from seniors about the property tax refund and how those refunds can be accelerated. Adopting the governor's recommendations to extend the deadline will help in those situations where seniors are finding it hard to pay for the second half property tax payment and they don't want to wait 18 months. As it relates to the department's position on this bill, first we really appreciate Representative Petersburg in taking on this, and we also really appreciate the work that our staff has done with staff here at the House. We did offer an alternative on Monday. There were new items that were added to that alternative, and we're still reviewing that draft to ensure that there's clarity so there aren't any issues about interpretation. Finally, Mr. Chair, while we appreciate the opportunity to share information about the deferral program, the governor's proposal, and our reaction to this bill, we need to be clear for the record about our concerns about recent communication about the bill before you and the department's actions. We had received ideas from Ms. Lee in previous years on making changes to the senior citizens property tax deferral program. Her past proposal focused on modifying lien requirements or application requirements. We provided consistent feedback that changing the application requirements or the lien requirements takes a statutory change and cannot be done administratively, and that we would be concerned about lowering requirements for a lien because if seniors were put in a situation where the property value could not support repayment to the debts attached to the property, including the deferred property taxes, it could put them in a dire financial situation. With the feedback given, we've encouraged Ms. Lee to find a legislative author willing to carry those provisions if she's seeking to make a change to the application requirements or the lien requirements. The bill before you is different than the approaches that we've seen in previous years. But with that said, we really do appreciate Ms. Lee working with Representative Petersburg to come up with an approach. While that describes our communication in the past couple years, recent emails from Ms. Lee have included concerning subject lines such as how many more must die and stop Department of Revenue's contribution to elder abuse and death of seniors. I want to be very clear on the record that those statements are not accurate. They're disappointing because they disparage the work of dedicated public servants who are faithfully administering the statutes passed by the legislature. We have worked with many seniors either by phone, email, or in writing to help them understand the program and to get them approved when allowable by statutes. Our program administrators consistently meet all the deadlines set out by this program. While there may be disagreements about how to modify the statutory authority for the senior deferral program, to suggest that the Department of Revenue, by administering this program prescribed in statute, is contributing to elder abuse is inappropriate and inaccurate. If this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative Petersburg, and staff, and thank you for the opportunity to come before this committee and testify.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Anyone else would like to testify? Representative Lunan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in spite of the testimony of Mr. Petersburg's witness, I'm going to speak in favor of this bill. But I want to talk about why we have this situation. This is a needed program, but it's a needed program because government allows school districts and cities to have special elections on a day other than the normal election time. And I was on the school board in Shakopee, and I watched them do this. I opposed it every time, where they would have it about now, maybe a little earlier in the year than right now, because that diminished the elderly vote, who would typically oppose an increase in tax, not because they won't pay the tax, but they can't. They're on a fixed income. They're all set up and budgeted. People are put in a situation not just because of the property tax, because of the property tax increases. In my district, we just saw our property tax go up 24% plus for the second year in a row. One because of a voter-approved school bonding issue, and another one for an issue that the voters never got to vote on. So we're creating a government program to solve a problem created by a government allowance of, I'll call it, election gerrymandering. This is a good bill because it does allow seniors to stay in their home. I have this going on a lot in my district right now. I'm a Main Street business. They come in, they know me. I've been in town for 36 years working, so they know. They come in, they talk to me about this problem, and I see this. I'm surprised to hear that it was only 300 and some people utilizing that, because a portion of those have to be from the city of Shakopee, because we've got going on. When you keep seniors in the home, not only is it cost effective, but more importantly, it does add to the quality of your life. So this is an important bill. I just want to give context of why we have to do this. It's a fix for a fix is really what we're doing.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. So, Representative Lunan, that speaks highly of the election timing bill I had last time, which did not go in the law.
Right, that's exactly right, that they go through and they vilify the seniors. So what they do is they justify, create a situation where they know there's going to be a low incidence of voting. I was in the meeting, so I heard them say it. And not factoring in, there are people that the situation we're putting them in is totally disregarded. And so it's their voice is a little bit quelched in the process. It's frustrating.
Thank you. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is to Mr. Cummins, if he would like to come back. And while he's coming there, I guess I would like to reiterate my support for his comments about the disparaging remarks made. This is the legislature. We're used to inflammatory remarks, I guess, but nonetheless, it's counterproductive to make false claims about legislation. Mr. Cummins, you, in your testimony, mentioned a income threshold of $60,000. Could you, for household income, could you clarify that a little bit? Is that of all income, or is that exclusive of Social Security transfer payments, or any other, pension payment, or is it earned income, or is it any income?
Mr. Cummins.
I feel like one of the questions that we will have this year, Mr. Chair, is what is income? We'll have to determine that by the end of the year. But with that said, I'm wondering if House Research knows what we're using for income in this, or maybe,
I see Mr. Cummins, that Mr. Hines is searching in his statute book, so it might not quite be clear yet. We can maybe come back to that question.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you. And while they're looking that up, I guess the reason I'm asking is this is a question I get frequently about property taxes, particularly for districts similar to mine that are collar districts around the metro. And what we do know is that in these collar communities, the property tax burden for families is exceeding 5% of household income, which is not the proportion that we're seeing in the greater Minnesota area. And to Representative Lunan's point with regard to why so few apparently are using the program, I might be suspect of that income threshold being the limitation why there are so few that are using it. One of the problems that are being faced in the collar communities right around the metro is that many of these communities are rapidly joining the ranks of the 92 cities now in the state that don't get any local government aid, so that is a added pressure upon the local property taxpayer, not to mention fiscal disparities, which is shipping dollars out of the community to other parts of the state and putting an extraordinarily high burden on them. So maybe we have that answer now, or?
Well, I think we do, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hurtas, the income definition refers to all household income, including taxable and non-taxable income and Social Security, etc.
Thank you, Representative Hurtas.
Mr. Cummings. I apologize, Mr. Chair. The show was giving me a note. I didn't hear that answer.
He said it includes all income.
All income. All right.
Mr. Cummings?
And Mr. Chair, just looking back at a brief survey, about 5% of the denials are due to because they had too much income. So about one out of every 20 denials.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to direct this question to Mr. Cummins, and I do want to reiterate what Representative Hertas says. I've had very positive interactions with you and your staff and appreciate the work that you provide for us and our citizens. My question has is going back to, you said it was a low-interest loan, so I'm not sure if you said this and I didn't hear it, but I was just wondering what the interest rate on the loan is. How frequently is that interest rate adjusted? And then is that interest charged to the taxpayer annually, or is that, again, put on as part of the lien that you mentioned earlier?
Mr. Cummings.
I think I'm going to have Mr. Heinz answer this. I can answer this, but I think he could probably provide a more detailed response.
All right, Mr. Heinz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barthy, the rate specified is that it's a formula-driven rate, so I don't know exactly what it is, not to exceed 5%. So it's 5% or less. If Mr. Cummings may have further information about what it really is right now, it refers to a statutory section that has some reference to another rate. And as far as how it's applied, it does just get put on at the end of to the lien, so that the taxpayer is only obligated to pay the 3% of their income while they're in the program.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this program is underutilized by people who are having a hard time, which is the basic cost of living and the increases in that, and I've referred many people to it. I think it's not as well known, and I think part of it is because it's competing with reverse mortgages and other things that for many people are much less to their financial advantage. I had a constituent who called me about a reverse mortgage loan and who found out that the closing costs, even though her house was 100% paid for, were three times what her children buying their first house were paying in closing costs, and even though it was 100% equity. And I think that part of it is we just don't do enough financial education for seniors. And when I looked on the senior linkage line, I didn't see this really kind of a compare and contrast of options to help you if you're having a hard time affording your living expenses. And I would encourage the Department of Revenue to work with the senior linkage line and Minnesota Help Info, because I think they can do a better job of helping people compare and contrast. Because what I have found when I've talked to people about this program, because we're clear and transparent, if you look at the information that the Department of Revenue provides and our counties often distribute, it's very clear about the obligation and how it gets paid, and it has that lien word that tends to scare away people of a certain generation because they may have heard of stories during the Depression of people losing their homes, that sort of thing. And, you know, but they don't understand when they take out a reverse mortgage. That is the same thing. They're just giving the equity away month by month instead of after the time that they sell the house or it transfers to someone else and or they are no longer able to live there. And I think that we really need to do a better job of partnering in helping seniors really understand their options, because when I've dealt with them, they hear that word and it's like the door is closed, and yet then we talk about, well, if you take out a home equity loan or a reverse mortgage, it's the same thing. But the advertising for those programs never uses that word. They're not as clear and transparent. And so I think that part of why this isn't used is just because we need, all of us need to take some responsibility for better informing people about their financial opportunities and help that's available, because we do have a lot of seniors who are just really struggling because cost of living has gone up and they're on a fixed income. So I appreciate the discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Before you do, Representative Loeffler, I think Representative Loon disagrees with you.
Not that kind of lean. I like that. The Ben Lean's type of lean. It's that lean against a property in financial terms I was referring to.
But you couldn't resist,
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
I just wanted to ask, you mentioned the senior linkage line and then you referenced another organization, Representative Loeffler?
Minnesota Help Info.
Help Info, okay.
I think that's the generic online directory to state services.
Thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment. Back in the 80s, I had a friend that had some financial difficulties. I said, is there a lien on your house? He says, lien?
there's so many leans on my house, it's leaning so bad it's going to tip over. But I think something, a program like this is probably better suited, given to what I was talking about earlier, to be fixed to a percent of the burden of property taxes to your income, because as Representative Marquardt has so often talked about how regressive property taxes are, the assumption is that because you live in a house you have the ability to pay, but oftentimes for people who have been there a long time, and especially in areas of rapid growth or development, you're kind of swept into the tide of rapidly rising values in which you have do not have the ability to continue to pay those property taxes.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Lee.
Yes, I'd like to respond back to the legislatures, and I apologize if some of the emails that went out, you know, caused the reaction that it did. It wasn't meant to be disparaging, but we did not have numbers on a lot of things. I officiated over the funeral, over the person who died, and in the debriefing with the family, it was something that could have been prevented, but the issue was the contributing factor was the reaction of the senior to the foreclosure, and that they had tried, the family had tried to go through the senior deferral program as a last resort, but it just, so it was to explain that there were other things that were happening as a result. These are the different tracks that could happen: the confession, the judgment, or their house gets foreclosed. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is that I appreciate what the Department of Revenue is trying to do. And as far as the liens that Mr. Cummings was talking about, I think one of the cases I mentioned we had is that there were no liens on the property, but the recorder's office showed there were liens or something to that effect, and that had to go through a court process to get cleared, or else the abstract company had to disregard the liens that really weren't applicable. But that was the process that was holding up that thing. So we were looking for to keep those applications pending until they could get all that thing straightened up that's happening in these other systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Your apology, I think, is accepted by the members here, and we want to move forward and work with you to make this program better. So thank you for that. One quick question, Mr. Cummings. Any idea what the amount of the average deferral is? Maybe as mentioned in the testimony. I don't know. Does anyone know?
I don't know. Maybe...
That's okay. I just thought you might.
Yeah.
Well, Ms. Shum, I have an idea.
Mr. Chair and members, I remember reading something, and I think it's dated information, but I want to say that the cost is around $500, and that's an average. It depends on how long the homeowner stays on the program. And so, as what was mentioned before, it's a revolving door. Sometimes it's a very short time period. Sometimes it's up to, 5 years? I don't think we have any more than that, but I will check into that and get back to you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Maybe a question for Mr. Hines. I can't remember, on the 3% that the seniors are required, is that 3% of their income they're required to pay in property taxes each year, and then the rest is deferred? What's that 3% threshold?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, that's correct. They're required to pay 3% of their income. And so essentially the deferral is paying everything over and above that, and they need to pay that themselves.
Mr. Chair, so I think one reason why the senior deferrals might be so low is because the property tax refund program is pretty robust. And especially when you're looking at the 30 to 40 thousand income range, I think that initial threshold is probably 2% or less, and then the state picks up 80 to 90%, so it might actually be better to go through the property tax refund program. So there might even maybe to look at that threshold percent might be able to incent more seniors into that program, because right now under the property tax refund program they might be actually doing better than that. I'm just kind of thinking right now. But
thank you.
So you bet.
Anyone else? Okay. Representative, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Yeah. Representative Petersburg, if you want to give final thoughts, we'll move to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee for hearing this bill. I also would like to just say I'm sorry that me carrying this bill forward has created the disparaging remarks moving forward. That was not my intention, nor was I envisioning that. But getting to Representative Loeffler's piece about how one of the reasons for carrying this bill is also I hope that this brings it more to the attention of others so that people can utilize it if it works well for them. I think as you can hear from the various testimonies and the things, there are certain situations in which we're still going to be dealing with issues in regards to that. But this bill here really is an attempt to make it easier moving forward, making it clearer for those that are going to participate in the program how it's going to work, give them a little bit more opportunity to be able to participate and remedy some of the defects in their application. So thank you for your consideration. I please ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg, for grabbing the handlebars on this bill and bringing it in, steering it into committee. With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 2254 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Dabney, House File 1123. Representative Loeffler moves that House File 1123 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chipper.
Chipper day.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1123 looks to increase the homestead valuation exclusion for our disabled veterans. This program was first passed in 2008, 10 years ago now, and while the benefit has been expanded in terms of its application, applying to the surviving spouse, things like that, it has not been, the valuation included has not been expanded in those 10 years. There may not have been a need to do that for a number of years when the property market was down, but the property market has come back at this point, and I believe it's a good time to look at the valuation that we allow disabled vets, 100% disabled vets, receive an exclusion of 100% of their property tax, property taxes of up to $300,000. Disabled vets at lower levels a lower exclusion. So I think it's time that we review that given the robust nature of the property market at this time. With that, Mr. Chair, I believe there are some people with of concern in the audience.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Mr. May. Welcome, Mr. May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom May, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. First, I'd like to say that we fully support veterans' benefits, and we fully support the concept of the veterans' exclusion. With that said, though, every year we do see a multitude of bills to expand this program. I believe this year we have six House bills already introduced, and this, of course, is a bill from last year that's carried over. We do know, according to the fiscal notes, that this is a shift onto other properties in the vicinity of the veterans' excluded homes. We just believe that this should be a state-administered and funded program so that the burden of this program is equal across the state and doesn't lie disproportionately on those areas around veteran medical facilities. So that's our position on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of four suburban counties and 10 greater Minnesota regional centers. I basically would like to reiterate Mr. May's comments. We agree it's appropriate to honor these individuals for their service to Minnesota. But I would like to remind the committee that every time you pass an exclusion, an exemption, a reduced class rate, or increase an existing exemption or exclusion, as this bill does, there is a price to pay on that and is borne by the state's property taxpayers. Currently, over 15,600 veterans exemptions have been granted in the state. Nearly $2.4 billion evaluation has been excluded as a result, and as Mr. May has indicated, the cost of that is borne by other property taxpayers to the tune of probably in excess of $25 million. The current exclusion at $150,000 for those with disabilities between 70 and 99% is quite generous. The current exclusion for those with 100% disability rating is very generous at $300,000. Whether or not that needs to be increased to honor these veterans for the service, I'll leave to the opinion of the division. But again, we have concerns about the continued expansion of this particular preference, and this is one of a series of bills that this division is going to see on this subject.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Anyone else who would like to discuss this bill? Questions, members? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to clarify, testifier made the statement that all exclusions are a shift to other property taxpayers. And in this circumstance, it is. But last year, we did an exclusion on the state level, state general levy, which was fully captured, and that was not a shift to other property taxpayers.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Markwick.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dabney, for bringing this forward. And when this was enacted in 2008, I know the $150,000 and $300,000 levels were sensitive to kind of the market at the time. So it would seem logical to adjust that in relationship. And I don't know if this is the right approach or if there's actually, which would be more complicated, what we do with the first tier of Ag Homestead, where it's raised at first at 0.5 is raised according to the value of the land. And I don't know if there'd be a statewide number where you get an increase in value of market value that could automatically inflate. I don't know. But I do know at the time in 08, as Representative Dabney mentions, it was sensitive, you know, 150 and 300, even though we wanted kind of good round numbers, it was sensitive to kind of the market at the time. And certainly that has changed. So thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Dabney.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. With that, Representative Loeffler, reintroduce her motion that House File 1123 be laid over for possible inclusion. And the House File is laid over. Members, two things. Mr. Hines has has done his speedy research on the Speedway, and so Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, in reference to the question that came up about whether if the association was able to get the 501c3 status, if that would make them exempt, and there is a statute that provides that if the lease is for a period of 1 year or longer, that even if they're not the one statute that provides that a leaseholder has to pay property taxes refers to for-profit, but then there's a second one that says even if they're not for-profit company, they're still liable to for property taxes if the lease term is 1 year or longer. So simply getting the 501c3 would not get them out of that under current law.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Ms. Schill has a sheet, members, and I'll turn over to Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, this is a housekeeping item. As you know, the governor released his budget recommendations late last week, and what you have are two spreadsheets in front of you. It looks like this. The 8.5 by 11 cover sheet shows the change items that are included in this year's governor's March 2018 budget recommendations. Includes a change to the homestead credit state property tax refund, to an item discussed today, the senior property tax deferral reimbursement, and Mr. Cummings talked about that where there is a change in date and then the occupancy requirement from 15 years to 5 years. And then there are certain items that will have property tax administration impacts, mostly changes in the revenue side of the spreadsheet, which is a purview of the overall tax committee. The 11 by 14 pages shows how these changes impact the February forecast. If you have further questions on the presentation here, please let me know. But this is your update right now.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I forgot one thing. The one thing you will not find on those spreadsheets are the impacts suggested by the governor for the state general levy, the inclusion of or the revisiting of reinstating the inflation factor for the state general levy. That is included on the revenue side of the spreadsheet. If you have questions about that one, please come see me.
It's good it's not reflected here, Michelle. Come on. Anyway, questions for Michelle? Okay, seeing no other business before us, we will, Mr. Helms, I think you're working on your simulation and we'll have that for us next week, is that right? Okay, so we'll look forward to that next week with our bills as well. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.